Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of consideration should go into the moral dilemmas that seem to present no clear answers? And how can we know we're following the right path once we make a tough call? As the original author of the New York Times Ethicist column for 12 years, Randy Cohen pondered nearly 700 ethical quandaries, offering what he saw as the best reasoned case for ethical action and occasionally responding to reader feedback to admit his advice had been wrong and explain why. Cohen has shared some of his most memorable responses in his new book, Be Good: How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. Randy, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
So what you discovered when you started doing this was that often people have a sense of what they ought to do, but what they crave is a rationale for why they have to do it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, exactly. That was a great relief to me. When I first got the job, I thought, what if I give someone terrible advice, you know, and they get hit by a bus? You know, it was, the pressure seemed unbearable. And as I went along, I went, well, who do I think I am? No one is really writing for that, or at least not often. You could tell by the way the question was phrased that people often knew what they should do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't rob that bank. Yes, you must return that wallet you found. Please don't be mean to that dog. But they didn't know why. And that's what they wanted from me, because they would think, well, it's an awful dog. You know, it pees all over the couch. It's chewing up my shoes. Why can't I just give it a boot? And you think, well, because animals have moral standing. They can experience suffering. And I was, that was my job, to kind of present a reasoned, logical, clear case for why a particular action is right action. And in this, I felt often that I was running a kind of salon, that I'd present a moral quandary. I would make my case for right action. And then the readers would chime in right away with other aspects of the question I might not have gotten to. It was really wonderful once looked at that way.
And it's great, too, that you seem to not have felt constrained by the need to be very serious all the time. Even when the subject is serious, there are ways to approach it in a way that is a little bit lighter.
Well, I might quibble with you just a bit. That I think what you're referring to is that the column is often funny. At least I hope so.
Right.
But I would say the opposite of funny isn't serious. It's somber. That humor doesn't bespeak triviality. That you can tackle any subject in a humorous way. It's a matter of tone or a kind of rhetorical choice. And I'll give you the example of much of the whole tradition of Jewish humor is often gallows humor. It's very dark. It's, you know, a people suffering for thousands of years mediated to humor as a way to get at something true about the human experience.
Did it make it easier, though, at times to sort of slap people on the wrist for things that they had done that were ethically not okay?
Yes, I agree with you completely. Although I tried not to do too much of that. That I didn't want to discourage people from putting questions to me in a good faith way, even if they sometimes seem to be writing in just to get the approval of the New York Times for stealing a car, you know, for doing things that they knew were wrong, and somehow thought if it could be endorsed by the Times through me, that would mitigate their wickedness. So every now and then, a very gentle slap. But the other part of this is I wasn't so much making judgments about people as about actions.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a difference between ethics, or at least as I've come to think of it, and religion, it's not for me to judge someone as a person. It's not for me to decide who gets into heaven or someone's innate worth. But my job was to talk about a particular action they took, and that judgment should be the same for everyone who takes that action.
It is interesting the places where ethics and morals and even etiquette overlap, and then there are places where there are clear divisions. Sometimes what might be the polite thing to do is not the ethical thing to do.
Well, sure. I mean, if it were 1850, you know, and we were living in the South, you know, there were all sorts of rules of courtesy for how we would treat our slaves.
Right,
you know,
right.
There was a whole code of etiquette, but it had nothing to do with ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Etiquette is often the embodiment of just the mores, the customs of a particular culture, sometimes with a moral underpinning, often without. And sometimes it's just neutral. Like one distinction I make, if a matter of etiquette truly affects someone, another person, then it rises to the standard of ethics. So there, I learned when I was a kid about giving up my seat to someone on the bus to mm-hmm. someone who needs it. You know, that I think rises to the level of ethics, even though it was taught to me as manners. But a decision about which fork to use, or do you have I'm assuming you have a lot of forks, that doesn't really have an effect on the well-being of another person. So it's etiquette, but not ethics, I would say.
What I love about this book is that it demonstrates, and about the column over the years, is that it demonstrates that you can't, there's not a blanket answer for things, because you mentioned giving up a seat on the bus. Somebody wrote into you and said, my wife wanted to sort of let someone sit next to us on the bus who had refused to sit next to a person of color, but it was an older person, and my wife felt like she should give that person a seat. And you were not okay with that.
No, I wasn't. I thought to give that person a seat, there was a seat. If there were an old person on the bus and we think, oh, I know that person's a terrible racist, you still have to give them a seat. But if there's another seat, there was another seat. Mm-hmm. It was next to a black person. This person simply chose not to sit in it out of, you know, despicable racist feelings. Well, to give that person a seat by offer them a seat over, oh, here's a seat by a white person, is simply to abet racism. I thought that was an actively terrible thing to do.
Hmm. There was another case where somebody wrote about having gone to see a performance of The Nutcracker and said, am I a racist that I'm bothered that this one character was danced by a black dancer and not a white dancer?
Right. It was a black dancer portraying a snowflake.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is...
Of course that's racist.
Yes. But this person... Here was a distinction, I think, that this person wasn't being actively malicious, was not trying to do harm to someone. That's true, and that's often what people take the meaning of racism to be, but that's not quite right. That racism is we're making judgments on the basis of race, and that it seemed particularly ludicrous, you know, that this person thought, oh, this is strictly an aesthetic decision, you know, mm-hmm. independent from any cultural context. But what we're talking about here is a giant dancing snowflake. What would realism mean here? You know, you've already
yeah.
made such a leap that what difference did it make? The race is a dancer. But it's, you know, I don't mean to apologize for racism, but this was, I remember an older person who was not trying to do harm, but I think needs to think a little more deeply about making decisions based on race.
You know, though, it seems like a good sign that people even go home and are bothered by having objected to that. You know what I mean? Like the fact that someone wrote into you and said, wait a second, is a good sign, don't you think?
Oh, completely. That I was so impressed with the people that sent questions into the column. And I know, I realize it's not a cross-section of America. It's people who read the ethics column in the New York Times and 40 syndicated newspapers at its height. There probably aren't 40 other papers now. But these were people who lived in a moral universe, who saw the ordinary decisions of daily life as having moral dimensions, and who genuinely wanted to do the right thing, mm-hmm. or at least have someone give them a really good excuse for doing the wrong thing.
You know, whenever we're in a political season, this sort of thing comes up, and there are numerous examples of when someone has followed the letter of the law, but has not necessarily behaved in an ethical way. Can you talk about why you think the law so often falls lower than the standard of ethics?
Well, the law is a complicated and interesting thing, and that what's illegal is not necessarily synonymous with what's ethical. And again, as long as we're sort of in the realm of American history and race, that for much of our history, slavery was legal,
right.
But it was never ethical. So the law can mean a lot of things. It can simply be an expression of power. You know, why is there the capital gains tax is so low, but the taxes working people pay so high? Well, because the people who have a lot of capital gains have the power to get the law written their way. But it's not just power. The law is also, in many ways, an attempt at a code of justice, of real fairness for a culture, an expression of a culture's values. So you can't rely on the law as an unvarying guide to moral conduct, but it's certainly worth consulting the law as at least a starting point for a decision. Otherwise, you're going to, you know, be in jail for smoking that pot. Even though I think if you smoke pot alone at home, you have no drug problems, you harm no one, that seems to me, I don't see that as unethical, although it's very much illegal, I guess, pretty much every place, most places in America. So it's necessary that I at least address the law when I gave advice in the column, but I didn't necessarily tell people to obey the law.
Are we ethically obligated to try to change laws that we know are unethical?
It's a pretty idea, isn't it? But I don't know how big your super PAC is or how many
millions of dollars
you spend every year in lobbying for laws you think was. but I think regardless of your politics, you'll accept the idea that people with money have a lot more influence on the laws we have than people without.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to get that kind of criticism at the column a lot when I advised someone that, well, this law is not something you have a moral obligation to obey. And they say, well, that's a terrible thing to say. You should tell them they have to change the law. And I said, yeah, well, why not tell them they have to fly? You know, that's really asking more what people could do and certainly more than anyone could do in the short term. So it seems more a statement of an American myth. It's one of our cherished myths that's so vital and fluid is our democracy that if you object to a law, you can go out and get it changed. Well, maybe sometimes, sure.
Randy,
but not often and not easily.
Randy Cohen is with us. He wrote the New York Times column, The Ethicist, for 12 years, and now he's the author of the new book, Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll talk to Randy again in a few minutes. Right now, we want to pause, take a break to remind you that we are in the midst of the fall fundraising campaign. Actually, we hope to be nearing the end. We reached beyond the halfway point this morning, far beyond the halfway point, right? We have 3,000 overall contributions left to go, Jeff, something like that?
I have no idea.
Okay. I saw an email at like 10:30 this morning that we were down below 3,000. We are looking in Think today to get a total of 200 contributions in order to receive a $1,000 bonus from the folks at the Arlington Casuals Square Dance Group. You can help with this by being one of those 2,000 contributors by going online to KERA.org or calling 1-888-694-6931.
Thanks, Chris. It just hit me, you know, this how long have I been here today? But, you know, you can help ease the pain of continuing this challenge by calling right now, 888-694-6931, or going online to kera.org. And Chris, you're right. We have a 200 contribution goal by 2 p.m., 106 contributions left to go. So we really do need to hear from you right now, or we're going to have to turn down this $1,000 additional gift to KERA from the Arlington Casuals Square Dance Group. And there's a great reason to support the station, not just because you use it and you listen to it, and it's probably the right thing to do. I'm going to talk to Randy
about that in a few minutes.
I think that's probably a good idea. And we have copies of Randy's book.
We do. They are available as a thank you gift when you make a contribution at or above the $120 level. Really a fascinating book, Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. It is divided up into a number of different chapters, and there are headings about school and technology and the ethics of medical care and the arts and communities and love and sex and religion and everything else. Really a fascinating book. It's the kind of thing that I think you could page through just for entertainment any day. You could read it cover to cover, but you don't have to. You can sort of just pick and choose the things that are interesting to you. A lot to learn here. A lot of great fodder for discussion. It's not the sort of book that book clubs read, but I think it would be a fantastic book club book.
Well, and I'm worried because we have a limited amount of time to get you to respond before 2 p.m., and we still need 106 contributions in order to make the goal, stay on track to end the drive tomorrow. So please call right now, 888-694-6931, or go to kera.org and click and join there and pick up your very own copy of Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything by Randy Cohen. When you join the station, just become a member at the $10 a month sustaining membership level or $120 all at once, and we will happily thank you with your very own copy of the book.
1-888-694-6931 is our telephone number. You can also make your contribution online, get the whole thing taken care of digitally at kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Randy Cohen.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Randy Cohen, who wrote the New York Times ethicist column for 12 years and is the author of the new book, Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. You can be part of this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Randy, I know that this is not, you didn't study philosophy in college, you were not an ethics major. Are you an autodidact? How did you find the information you needed?
It was as much a surprise to me and to all who know me as it is to you that I had this job. I certainly don't have a philosophy background. I was a music major in college, and a darn bad one, I might add.
Were you really, truly?
Yeah, I was. I went to grad school as a composition student, and I had no gifts of any kind. I didn't realize it until quite late in my education. The Times knew me as a writer, and I had written for the magazine before, and the Book Review, and other parts of the paper. And they had many candidates audition for this job. I mean, they gave us three questions, very much like what runs in the column. Mm-hmm. How they chose me, I don't know. I always felt clerical error. I don't know, because I do seem unlikely, but perhaps because the kind of writing I'd done in the past, or at least what I enjoy as a reader, is often humorous, but takes a kind of critical view of the culture. Mm-hmm. I like that kind of comedy as an audience member anyway, and is analytical in its approach. And these often seem like little moral quandaries to sort out. So I didn't consult authorities on moral reasoning, although I often consulted experts on technical matters. So, so that if there was a question, say, about, I got many questions from doctors, so I would go to a medical ethicist at the AMA, among others, and she would take me by the hand and go, well, here's the standard medical practice in that case. Here's what our code of conduct says a physician should do. And I didn't have to endorse that, but some pretty smart people had thought about these questions, and I should at least become aware of what they had to say.
There are cases, right, where really intelligent, critical thinking people reach different conclusions.
Oh, yes. And that's what made the job both challenging and fascinating.
Yeah.
These are very much questions about which honorable people differ. And the readers of the New York Times were not shy about pointing out those differences. And sometimes with eloquence, with civility, and with real intelligence, and would persuade me that I'd simply gotten one wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would go back and revisit a question and, you know, confess my folly and try to reason my way to a more compelling conclusion. I was very wary the first time I did that. I thought I would lose credibility somehow. And this would always be thrown in my face for the rest of my time at the column. Well, why should we believe you? You know, you were so wrong about that question about sneaking onto the subway. You know, you're such a foolish person. Which I think is why many public figures are reluctant to change a position.
You know,
politicians, you know, just dig their heels in. You know, and you think, well, isn't this something we admire in thinking people? They're able to actually reevaluate their own ideas and think, oh, well, maybe there's a better way to see it. And I found when I confessed folly, the readers were so generous. I wasn't mocked for it. I was, if anything, applauded for it.
Well, it's so refreshing, right? Because what we do is we say something, and then if you say it in public, God forbid you change your mind, you have to build this scaffolding around it to explain why it's still right. I mean, why is it so hard for us to say, I did this, I believed it at the time, gave it some more thought, learned some more things, and I've changed my position. Why is that so rare?
You say it. Well, I think for the first thing we were saying, that if you once admit error, it can undermine your credibility. And if you have rivals, I don't really think of myself as someone with rivals, but this can be thrown in your face. And I think, you know, it's a kind of marital thing, you know, any acknowledgement of error from 20 years ago. Yeah, like that time you got the heater repaired. Is this going to be as good as that? You know, it's all evidence in the ongoing struggle it is marriage. I think that's one reason why. And I've come to think the most beautiful sentence in the English language is, you were right, I was wrong. It's a sentence we don't get to hear very often.
How did the emergence of technology in everybody's office, in everybody's pocket, in everybody's hand change the kinds of questions you were asked over the years?
It did very much. This what you're describing represents the biggest change in the kind of questions I got over those 12 years. And it wasn't so much that moral precepts changed. The underlying morality was the same, online or offline. But we were placed in situations where a code of conduct had not yet emerged.
Mm-hmm.
Cultures change slowly. We have to adjust to things. And I'm thinking particularly of questions about privacy, our whole idea of privacy, questions arising from, say, Facebook and Google. I remember in I think the first year of the column, a woman was being set up on a blind date, and she wanted to know if it was okay to Google the guy. was this too intrusive? Was this akin to hiring a private detective? And it seems so quaint now, that no one would think twice about that.
You'd be crazy not to.
Yeah, I think so. You'd be a little rash. And yet, this was, just 13 years ago, this was not so obvious as it is today. And there are also many questions about intellectual property. I'm thinking illegal music downloads or students who are a little fast and loose with the kind of reference material they find online and failing to cite their sources. Those kind of things come up, are just thrown up for grabs now, that we're put in new situations where honorable conduct is not obvious.
Well, we have this often misinterpreted quote about information wanting to be free, and a lot of people take that to mean the people who produce it don't deserve to get paid for their work.
Right, and which, of course, I should say right away that this, I completely disagree, and that everyone's entitled to be paid for their work, and as a moral matter, and then simply as a practical matter, well, what is this economic model? How do you expect novels to be written and records to be made? Records, I'm so old. if people can't make a living at it, that seems unsustainable to me. But I think part of this is the experience, especially for younger people, of going online is, well, everything's kind of right there, and you can just easily download it. And kids who would never have gone into a record store and, slipped a CD into their pants are quite free and easy. Apparently over half of all music downloads are still illegal. It's just an astonishing thing. And these are not young people who think of themselves as thieves. It's just a continuation of their ordinary experience, and it's going to take some sorting out.
I guess it's the anonymity that makes people feel like there's no victim, even though somewhere out in the world is some young person trying to make a living as a musician that is starving.
Quite right. I should also say that it's possible to err too much in the other direction. And that, when the founding fathers created the idea of copyright, it wasn't to maximize the profits of the Walt Disney Company. It was to promote science and the useful arts. That's how it appears in Article 8 in the Constitution. The idea was, well, we want to be a nation of innovation. And that requires two things. People have to come up with new ideas, but the ideas have to then spread through the culture. So they wrote into that, in the Constitution, we're going to give the creators of these ideas a limited monopoly, limited, for a limited time. That means, there's an incentive to come up with a new kind of plow, say, or write a new kind of book with new ideas in it. You get to make all the money from that for a limited amount of time, and then we want everybody to use those ideas. It was such an elegant balance, and the original term of copyright was 14 years. It's now the life of the creator plus what? Plus 20, is that right? I'm not a lawyer. I can't remember. But and every time copyright law is about to expire, or every time, I guess it's every time certain works, Mickey Mouse in particular, is about to fall into the public domain, somehow the copyright law mysteriously gets extended. It's sometimes called the Disney Protection Act, and the actual current version of the copyright law, and again, with this caution, I am not a lawyer and I can be misremembering this, but it's the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act. There's a name that is the highest striving for moral purity.
It almost sounds like an experimental band or something, actually.
So somewhere, it's a very challenging problem, that how do you find a system that both rewards the creators of new ideas and encourages people to do that, and yet doesn't stifle thought by making it impossible to have a really free exchange of ideas. Boy, that's tricky stuff. But I think one part of that is not letting copyright run as long as it does now.
You had an interesting case study in the book. You draw the line between buying counterfeit designer goods and buying knockoffs.
Right, right. Counterfeit merchandise constitutes fraud. You know, it has the name of a designer or the name of a manufacturer on it that in fact, did not design or manufacture it. That's fraud. That's lying. That's cheating. It's deceitful. You ought not encourage that sort of thing with your patronage. Knockoffs are a different matter. No ideas, and least of all in the world of fashion, are born fully formed out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Every idea is influenced by all the ideas that came before it. And so if something simply draws on earlier work, well, every musician draws on the work of earlier musicians. Every novelist draws on the whole history of literature. Go, copy. These now become judgments of quality. You know, I like this new design. I don't like this new design. But all ideas borrow from other ideas, and that's fine. But you have to be transparent about it.
I've actually heard people in the fashion industry say they sort of like knockoffs because it speeds the cycle for them to have to create something new that is now authentically cool.
There's also an argument that it adds value to the designer original. That becomes this rarefied thing that if you want that sort of endorses it by saying, this is such a brilliant design that it is necessary. We're eager to do knockoffs of it. Although, who's the shoe designer that has the red soles on the shoe?
Is that Christian Louboutin?
Yes. Ooh. Wow.
Very
impressive.
I've never owned a pair, but I've looked at them in magazines, which are about the budget of my shoe.
That
budget.
Company went to court to defend that, but they used the, you can't. There is no right now. There is no law that protects the designs of clothes. But they defended it as a trademark, as part of their trademark, which I thought was a sort of cunning backdoor way. But I thought it was a terrible, and they won, by the way, which I think is terrible. It's a travesty of justice. It's completely foolish. It would seem to me you ought not have intellectual protection for going for a color that will make our soul, the soles of our shoes. And there are people in the fashion industry who are hoping for promoting laws that would make designs patentable or copyrightable, depending on how you write the law, that it would be a protected idea. And I think, again, this will just stifle creativity, and that's too bad.
You and I can take a can of red spray paint, maybe, and just hit the bottom of our
shoes. You're cruising for, you know, the fashion police are going to haul you into court.
Believe me, that's not the reason they would take me into court. That's the least of my worries. Randy Cohen is with us. He wrote the New York Times ethicist column for 12 years, and he's got a fascinating new book out called Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We do have copies of Randy's new book, Be Good. It is available as a thank you when you make a contribution this afternoon to KERA at or above the $120 level. You do that by going online to KERA.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back in the studio now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. 92 contributions left to go to make our goal for Think Today. That's a 200 contribution goal by 2 p.m. So that we can achieve the challenge from the Arlington Casuals Square Dance Group. They're putting up $1,000, a $1,000 additional gift to the station if and only if we hear from at least 200 of you, and 92 contributions left to go this hour. We're running out of time here, folks, so if you've considered joining the station, if you'd like a copy of Randy Cohen's book, Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything, you can get that when you join the station with a $120 contribution. If you'd like a copy of our last hour's guest's book, Edible, Dallas and Fort Worth, the cookbook, that's still available at the $120 membership as well. If you make a $20 a month contribution, we'll send you both books. It's very easy to do. Just go online to kera.org or call 888-694-6931.
We are delighted to be able to bring public radio to the entire North Texas community. The way this is set up, the idea is that we don't have commercial advertising in the standard way. We are not beholden to sponsors, but we do come to you directly and say, look, if you like the product, if you rely on it, if it means something to you, then support it with a contribution at whatever level makes sense to you. Maybe you think you listen a dollar a day's worth. Maybe you think you listen a dime a day's worth. But your contribution contribution to the station is what makes it possible that we are on the air. We would not be here if nobody made contributions to KERA. It's quite that simple.
If the station had gone on the air in 1974 and no one had joined, no one had supported it, absolutely right, Chris. Public radio would not exist in North Texas. But for the generosity of thousands and thousands, quite possibly hundreds of thousands of people over the last 38 years who supported the station. And now it falls to you. I mean, it's your public radio station. You're listening right now. You have listened through this, the 6 days of this membership campaign. And our goal, as we've said all along, is to wrap this drive up in record time, 7,000 contributions in just 7 days. Well, tomorrow's the seventh day, but we're only going to make it. We're only going to be able to successfully conclude this membership campaign if you call or if you make your contribution online. Just go to kera.org. Hey, while you're there, surf over to kera.org/Australia and learn a little bit about this fantastic 11-day Australian trip that we're going to give away to one lucky listener. You can get automatically entered to win this trip when you make a contribution either at kera.org or by calling 888-694-6931.
Yes, it's donated by Discover Down Under. It really sounds fantastic, whether you've been to Australia before or you've always wanted to go. It's just another nice little addition that we are offering and hoping that it will convince you that now is the time to make your contribution at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Again, we have copies of Randy Cohen's book available at the $120 membership level. That, by the way, is the average gift, but it is by no means the only gift. Some people give us $1,500 a year or thousands. Some people give us in the tens per year, and we are really delighted to have your contribution in any amount. We understand that your budget is up to you, but we do hope that if public radio is something you value, you will consider making a gift of support.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Again, that number, it's toll-free. It's 1-888-694-6931. Or click over to kera.org and join the station online. It's actually saves the station a little bit of money if you join on the website. So if you do that, you can also check out the available thank you gifts there. And again, we have copies of Randy Cohen's new book, Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything, available when you join the station with a $10 per month sustaining membership. Do it right now, 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
Back in 2 minutes with Randy Cohen.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Randy Cohen. He wrote the original ethicist column for the New York Times for 12 years, and he's the author of the new book, Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Josh in Addison. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Great show today. I agree with just about everything your guest has said. But I wanted to ask him, it's not really an ethical question, but your downloading music example, to the average person, it things like that seem illogical, I think, because it seems like a lot of the laws that are written to protect that sort of thing are written to protect the big companies as opposed to individuals or small companies. And the example I can give you is, and it might not be the best one, but it's the only one I can think of offhand. I buy a DVD. I show it to a group of 150 people. I don't know, I'm having a party or something. And according to the law, I think in many circumstances, if you do that, you can be basically prosecuted in prison and fined for doing that because you're, I forget what it's called, but you're basically showing it to an audience. In reality, I'm showing it to 150 people who, if the movie's good, they might all go out and buy the movie themselves and tell other people about it, and they might buy it. I'm actually advertising the movie. But according to the law, I'm doing something illegal. So question really is, I mean, as you said, nothing's really original to begin with anyway at this point, but wouldn't it help if the laws seemed like they were much fairer and more logical than if they just seemed to protect large companies' profits?
What do you think, Randy?
The short answer is yes, that people are much more inclined to obey laws that seem reasonable to them. So just as a practical matter, that's quite so. But even though the law is, and always will be, imperfect, that doesn't give us the right to simply make it our choice about using someone's work without consent. Your example of having a party and showing some people a video, the reason that the cops didn't kick your door down is because it doesn't have many economic consequences. It's the same reason the record companies were not overly vigilant about people making cassette copies of music, that it's just so slow and clumsy to copy a cassette and to physically hand it to someone that it didn't have a big impact on their profits. Well, now, as I mentioned before, I believe the figure is 50%, somewhere around 50% of all music downloads are illegal downloads, which means it's a huge effect. It's so easy to do. It's so easy to send a song to someone that it means regular working musicians aren't getting paid, and the law must be reformed. A way has to be found that doesn't just protect the profits of big companies, although whether or not they're going to be big record companies for very much longer is something they themselves are not so sure of. But how do regular working musicians make a living at this? And it's going to become, now that people shift to e-readers, how do authors make a living? Not so easy even when it was books. So it's problematic. But I think you're a little too glib about, because the law is imperfect, I should just get to steal anybody's work.
Talk about this. Many people over the years have written to you in various iterations about their ethical obligation to report the wrongdoing of other people.
Yeah, challenging. By far the biggest category of questions I receive, they're what are broadly termed duty to report questions. You've done nothing wrong yourself, but you're aware of the wrongdoing of others. And maybe a coworker is stealing office supplies, or your college roommate has just downloaded a paper from the internet, that kind of thing. When do you have an affirmative moral duty to come forward and report this? And it's complicated, because we're not now just making a judgment about the act itself. We'll agree those two things are wrong. It's what do you have other duties to the person who committed the transgression? There are moral duties of friendship, for instance. And we don't want to live in a society where everybody's spying on everybody else and reporting every imagined misdeed. But we don't want to live in a world where people simply turn their backs on wrongdoing. And weighing all those things is really hard. And again, we were discussing the difference between what's legal and what's ethical, but it's just interesting to mention that in most jurisdictions, for most ordinary civilians, there is no legal duty to report wrongdoing. That if you witness a bank robbery, you don't have to call the cops. That's not your legal obligation. That there are particular professions that have some such duties that I believe in every jurisdiction, school teachers and pediatricians, for instance, have an affirmative legal duty to report suspected cases of child abuse. But in most other cases, most of us, most of the time, don't. It's funny that the law doesn't make that compulsory, but that ethics argues that there are times when you very much have to come forward.
When you know something is about to happen?
That I think, is one distinction, certainly. I would say here's one bright line, that you have an affirmative moral duty to report wrongdoing if it will prevent future imminent serious harm to another person. So if someone with a gun is coming over to my house, you have to call the cops.
Right.
But you have, I believe, a much weaker duty. You know, duties are measured not just do you have it or don't you have it, but how strong an obligation, how weak an obligation. To rectify a past injustice, you know, that 30 years ago, you know, I know that someone, you know, I have a friend who's a pirate, and he buried that pirate gold, you know. Must I report my friend the pirate? Well, there's a much weaker duty there, I think.
You know, one thing I love about this book is the things that you caused me to think about that I wouldn't have considered. Somebody wrote in and said, I went to a hotel, there was a mini bar, I was starving, and I ate the, you know, $49 box of cookies. But I went back the next morning and bought them at a 7-Eleven down the street and replaced them. So am I okay ethically? And you said no.
Right. My favorite questions are the ones also where the answer seems counterintuitive.
Right,
it's not
right.
The immediately obvious answer, because it seems like he did the right thing, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Who's harmed? You know, the mini bar after he's restored, you know, the $49 candy bar is now as it was before. All is back to normal. But I think not. And here's why. That what the hotel was providing was not just goods, but services. What you were paying for was the fact that that candy bar was available whenever you wanted it. So you're paying for their sending out some candy expert, you know, to scour the world to find the finest candy bars, and then to bring them to the hotel and build a beautiful fake walnut veneer mini bar, you know, and stock it. That all those services, that's what you're paying for. And simply replacing the raw materials does not compensate the hotel for its activities. And if you think it does, try it next time you go out to eat. Just show up at the restaurant the next morning with that chicken. You know, here's the chicken. You know, aren't we? Give me my money back. I don't think they will.
All right, I'm taking a risk here because I'm going to let you answer what you really feel the answer is. I mean, what sort of ethical obligation do listeners have, regular listeners, to make public radio contributions? And
I
should say you have your own...
This question at the column,
really?
And you'll be relieved to know, so you don't have to purge this from the air.
No, we wouldn't do that.
I genuinely believe they have a very strong obligation to contribute. If you're a regular listener, it's just the simple thing our parents tell us growing up, do your share, do your fair share. If you don't contribute, you're putting that burden on all the other people who do contribute. And that simply isn't right. The station needs money to operate. You enjoy what it's doing, you have to kick in. And sometimes this gets into what economists call the free rider problem, that one of the ways we rationalize not contributing, it's like this. You say, well, okay, I'm going to sneak onto the bus, because adding one more passenger to the bus doesn't really add anything to the cost of operating the bus, and that's true. You know, adding one more listener doesn't add any cost to the station. That's true. But if everyone makes that argument, then no one pays for the bus or the station. That you are a free rider. You are getting your bus ride or your public radio listening on the backs of other people who pay their share.
Well, thank you very much for that answer, and I appreciate it. I want to ask you, lastly, if you feel like this whole experience has made you a different person than you would have been if you'd spent the last 12 years writing about something else.
Well, if I'd written about, you know, Hollywood, I'd probably be dating like a glamorous actress instead of someone with, you know, a creature of staunch rectitude. I was so foolish in my career choices. What an idiot.
What a lucky lady to be a creature of staunch rectitude as described by you on the radio.
I don't know. Well, sometimes, yes. Actually, sometimes, yes. I'm very impressive people. In my conduct, I would have to say with some embarrassment, no. I don't believe I'm any more virtuous now than when I began the column, and that wasn't from a lofty moral height either. That I don't think I'm particularly virtuous or particularly wicked, and I don't think it was part of my job to be those things. I wasn't hired to be a role model for the kids. I was hired to write about ethics in a way the readers found engaging. And I don't know if you've met a lot of sports writers, but you know, there's not one in 10 of them that can hit the fastball.
Right.
And why should they? Mm-hmm. They're not hired to be athletes, but to write about athletics. I don't think it's changed my conduct. But what it has done, spending my working day thinking about matters of right and wrong, is make me aware of my own shortcomings. In a very vivid way, all the ways in which my conduct was less than it might have been, and that's truly demoralizing.
Well,
I mean, in a way, I guess it's
really?
It's a lot of all adults. You
yeah.
know, the older, if you're an adult and you haven't done things you regret, well, you just lack self-knowledge, and that's part of getting older, and we have to come to terms with that.
Randy Cohen wrote the New York Times ethicist column for 12 years. His new book is called Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. Randy, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks to all of you listening this hour. Thanks to all of you, especially who have become members of the station for the first time, for the 10th time, for the 50th. Well, we haven't been around 50 years, but we appreciate your contribution in any amount right now. If you would like to receive a copy of Randy Cohen's new book, Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything, we have it available for you at 1-888-694-6931 with a $120 contribution, or you can get it online at KERA.org. Interesting what Randy said about the whole free rider thing. I had not thought about being a public radio member in those terms before, but it is something to think about. You know, if you are a regular listener, you use the station, and you don't make a contribution, you're sort of putting the obligation off on everybody else who does contribute to pay for your share.
We talk about it all the time. I mean, that's what we're asking you to do. We're asking you to do your part to help make sure that the station that you use, the service that you rely upon, and the fact that you get some entertainment and education and information and news from this station, and it's not, we're not filling the hours with minutes and minutes and minutes of commercial messages from retailers who want your business. No, we're filling the hours with information and news and entertainment and great discussion like the one that we just had on the show. So if you value that, then yes, absolutely. It really is your responsibility to help preserve it and make sure that it's here to care for and feed and water the radio station. And you do that by making a phone call or making a contribution online.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can go online at KERA.org. Lots of thank you gifts there, including copies of Randy Cohen's new book, including the Edible Dallas and Fort Worth cookbook that we talked about last hour, and all the other books that we've talked about this week. Plus, you will be helping us, potentially, to receive the $1,000 challenge offered by the Arlington Casual Square Dance Group if and only if we can receive 200 contributions during the 2 hours of Think today. So we've got just a few minutes left to get this done. You can certainly help us. We have 88 contributions left to go. It's not impossible. We have the capacity on the line to take that many people in. If you start the process right now, you can certainly get us there. We really hate to leave $1,000 left on the table.
We do. And I do want to thank the generous folks at the Arlington Casuals Square Dance Group for the challenge. Again, it's a $1,000 challenge. We've got to hear from 88 more of you. And yeah, 88 of you, but really it's your call.
You and 87 other people.
Right. It's when you call right now, 888-694-6931, you're one, and then there's 87 more. And it works that way pretty quickly. When you go online to KERA.org, your contribution makes it 87 left to go. So please do your part right now. Pick up your very own copy of Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. Or if you're interested in a fantastic cookbook that's really just, it's beautiful, and it's all about food and what people are cooking and eating here in North Texas. It's Edible Dallas and Fort Worth, the cookbook, also available for just a $120 contribution. That's $10 a month. Don't you think what you hear on KERA is worth $10 a month? What you hear every single day here is worth just $10 a month? And plus, we're going to send you the cookbook. So what a fantastic deal. Go to KERA.org and make your contribution. Please do it right now.
Being a subscriber, a member of public radio, really is about doing the right thing even when no one's watching. Even though there is no one standing there ready to, stuff your radio speakers with cotton and things and pull the plug out of the wall. Mm-hmm. It's about doing it because you know it's a service you value, because you know that it's something that you want to be there, that you rely on, even though no one will slap you on the wrist if you don't make a contribution.
It's like your cases of scented candles that you have, so you can grab one when you're on the way out the door to somebody's house, Chris.
No one will keep me out of the party if I don't bring
That's
a candle,
right. but
they've come to expect it. Come to rely on it.
Let's make sure we invite the scented
lady. Chris Boyd's coming over.
Another cinnamon candle. She must have bought 1,000 of them. They must have been left over
at the dollar store.
They were left over from a pledge drive. No, you wouldn't. You would never show up. You would never show up empty-handed at a friend's house for a meal, for a party, and that's what you're getting here. We're asking you to show up with something. Really, it's the easiest way for you to have a huge impact. It's just to make an affordable, small, large, whatever, make a contribution to KERA. Make a contribution to your public radio station. Please do it right now, 888-694-6931.
You decide how much of your money it takes, and I can guarantee you that it only takes a couple of minutes of your time. So you can do this now online at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. You'll be supporting your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton, and online streaming at kera.org.
And don't forget, everyone who joins, everyone who makes a contribution is automatically entered to win this incredible 11-day, $11,000 value trip to Australia from Discover Down Under. You can check out all the details online at kera.org/Australia. And while you're there, make your contribution. You're automatically entered to win.
We are so thankful to all of you who have responded to our call for support. Those of you who support us every single drive, thank you very much. If you have not yet ever made a contribution to public radio, think about it now. Make a contribution to KERA and see how great it feels to support this station that you value. 1-888-694-6931 or online, kera.org.